For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, so we've moved from the narrative parts of this book. Now we're going to start studying the prophetic sections of Daniel. And to start that off, one of the things you have to understand when you approach this biblical prophecy, it's like no other book has anything like it. It's not found in any other religious text. Biblical prophecy is like a fabric, a matrix, a woven like tapestry. And one of the very important areas is the fact that everything we read in one passage is correlated in multiple other passages. As you start going through these different strains, just like if you saw somebody making a tapestry and, you know, they're feeding in blue thread at this point, they're feeding in yellow thread, and they're feeding in red thread, and you're like, okay, well, so what? Then you stand back, and there's the tapestry, there's the picture, and you go, whoa! That's the way prophecy is. You have to see the different strains laying over each other, and then you realize, and these are people, they didn't know each other, they never met each other, they lived in different centuries from each other. There was no way they could collude or you know, come up with this together, or why they would even want to. Correlated, it comes down in plain language. Yeah, there's symbolism, but it's not like you have to have some special like reading the tea leaves. Only the master can see what it says. You know, in this, anyone can see what it says, and rooted in history, so that when it refers to events and predicts events, they are real events that we actually know about from history. Tonight we'll be talking about a sequence of empires in the Middle East that are all very well known to historians. And the symbolism they use is there, but it's controlled by the text itself. And again, by correlation, the same symbols being used in these different accounts, different predictive visions or whatever, and when you line them up, you start to realize they all fit the same way, the same order and everything else. So to get that full picture isn't something that a casual reader can get. You have to be willing to read multiple different these layers that fit on top of one another, and then you start seeing down into it. And basically, it's only available to people that are willing to put a little work into it. So the idly curious basically never get this. And I think it's set up that way on purpose. It's like on a need-to-know basis. So if you really want to have your mind blown, you're going to have to go, not just tonight, you're going to have to go the next 3 to 4 weeks, because Daniel has 5 of these that line up, and what becomes convincing is when you see that lineup. That matrix form. Let's read. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled. He couldn't sleep. So this would be around before 600 BC, 601, 602. And we're in Babylon. Daniel is in this, has been taken prisoner and put into the school to become a government leader and a wizard, a religious seer. For some reason, when they call the wise men in to interpret this vision, Daniel's not among them. Probably because he's still a student. He hasn't graduated yet. So, because it says he went to school for 3 years, and yet this was the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. So the king summoned his magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. He has this dream that troubled him. He couldn't sleep. And so he brings them in, and he says, okay, tell me what I dreamed. They come in and stand before the king. Well, he says, I've had a dream that troubles me. I want to know what it means. Well, they're like, okay, king, I'll live forever. Tell your servants the dream and we'll interpret. Well, he's got a little, he's figured out a little verification idea because he feels like he's getting BS'd by these guys too much. And so he says, actually, this is what I firmly decided. If you don't tell me what the dream was and interpret it, I'm going to have you guys cut in pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. Well, if you can tell me the dream, though, and explain it, then you're going to receive from me gifts and rewards, a great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me. Well, they're like, okay, let the king tell his servants a dream, and then we'll interpret. Let's try this again. The king answered, I'm no, you're just trying to gain time because you realize this is what I firmly decided. If you don't tell me the dream, this is just one penalty for you. You've conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. And so then, tell me the dream, and I'll know that you can interpret it for me. They come back again. There's not a man on earth who can do what the king asks. I mean, no king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they don't live among men. Well, that's kind of, isn't that the whole point, that they're saying that they are diviners and they can make contact with the supernatural? That's how they know the future. That's how they interpret dreams. So, I mean, actually, what he's doing here is kind of smart, a little ruthless, but he's definitely, you know, if they can tell him what the dream was, then the only way they would know that would be the supernatural, and then he would know that they could trust their interpretation. This made the king so angry and furious, he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death. The men were sent out to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death, too, even though they were still in school. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him in wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, well, why did the king issue such a harsh decree? And Arioch explained the matter to Daniel. And this, Daniel went into the king and said, ask for time. Give me a little time and I'll deliver what you've asked. And he must have agreed to that. So Daniel returned to his house. He explained the matter to his buddies, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And he urged them to plead for mercy from God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed along with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Well, during the night, a mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. And then Daniel realized this is it. And praise the God of heaven. Oh, praise be the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He sets up kings and deposes them. He gives wisdom to the wise, knowledge to the understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank and praise you, O God of my fathers. You've given me wisdom and power. You've made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king. Well, they bring him in and bring him before the king. And Daniel says to Arioch, don't execute the wise man. Take me to the king. They bring him in. Daniel says to the king, Arioch says to the king, I found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means. King called him for him, and he says, are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and to interpret it? Look at Daniel's reply. No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he's asked about. No one can do that. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mystery. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the days to come. Your dream and the visions that pass through your mind as you lay on your bed are these. As you were lying there, O king, your mind turned to the things to come, and the revealer of mysteries showed you what's going to happen. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because I have greater wisdom than other living men, but so that you, O king, may know the interpretation and that you may understand what went through your mind. You looked, O king, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, the legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron, partly of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold are all broken into pieces at the same time and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that had struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. It says, this was the dream. And now we'll interpret it to the king. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's sitting there. He knows at this point, whatever comes out of Daniel's mouth next has to be directly from God, because he never told him the dream, and somehow he knows it. He says, you, O king, are the king of kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he's placed mankind, beasts of the field, birds of the air. Wherever they live, he's made you ruler over them all. You are that head of gold. Top part. After you, another kingdom will rise, inferior to yours. Then a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything, and as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Well, just as you saw that the feet and the toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. And as the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it ever be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of the mountain, but not by human hands, a rock that broke the iron, bronze, clay, silver, and gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future, and the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. Well, the king Nebuchadnezzar fell on the ground prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, surely your God is a God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery. And so, that's the background story. Now let's go back and figure out what's being said here. So we start out with a statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. All right. I'm guessing. He says the head was made of pure gold, okay, the chest and arms of silver, the belly and thigh of bronze, the legs of iron, and then the feet, a mixture of iron and baked clay. So then he goes to and he identifies these are a sequence of empires. We talked earlier in Daniel about the theme of the empire, the ultimate human position of power and glory. Not a king, but a king of kings, the master of the earth. And that theme, since Israel has been wiped out and are living as prisoners in the midst of the greatest empire on earth at the time, the Neo-Babylonian Empire, it raises these questions about power, glory, the pride of humanity, and God is basically giving a rejoinder, a rebuke to that in this series of visions that starts with this one. He comes out and says, straight up, you are the head of gold. So we don't have to guess at all about that. This starts with Babylon as the top of the statue. After you, he says, is going to come another one of lesser value than yours. And that, we can say with confidence, is the Medo-Persian Empire. Why do we think that? First of all, because of correlation. Next week, we're going to read a second vision, and it's the same sequence of empires, but this time it actually names the second one. It says it's the kings of Media and Persia. And so, since those line up together, we're going to be correlating these prophecies, each one of them. They all overlap and line up with one another. In that one, it's a series of beasts, and the two-horned ram that you saw represent the kings of Media and Persia, verse 20. And of course, historically, Persians are the ones that defeated the Babylonians. They wiped them out. And so, yeah, it makes sense that that would be the next. They having less power probably refers to the way that Nebuchadnezzar had absolute authority and could do whatever he wanted, change it at will, whereas the Persian emperors were bound by the laws, and even they could not change them once they passed one. So it had a lesser, more conditional type of power, Persia. Today, most people just call it the Persian Empire. The belly and thighs of bronze, again, we can identify with the Grecian Empire that began with Alexander the Great. The reason for thinking that, first of all, correlation. Again, in the next vision with the beasts, the third beast is a shaggy goat, which is the king. They identify him by name. It's the king of Greece. And the large horn between his eyes is the first king, Alexander the Great. It goes on to recount that horn's broken off right when he gains power, and four horns come in its place, which perfectly matches the division of the Grecian Empire into the four segments that followed Alexander's untimely death in his 20s. Well, also, who wasted Persia? It was Alexander the Great. They had never been a part of the action in the Middle East. The Greeks were over fighting each other all the time. But what brought them into the Middle East was that the Persians launched an attack against Greece. You know, 300 Spartans, that story. And they did it again. And we were defeated by the Greeks. And it's now, 100 years after that, they never forgot. These guys invaded our country and did so much damage here, and we're going to go get them. And so they invaded the Middle East and swept clear as far as India, took everything up, and also Egypt. Greece, Babylonia, Persia, Greece. The legs are of iron. That would be the Roman Empire. It's the Roman Empire that ran over the Greeks. It's also because iron, as he says, in as much as iron is stronger than any other and shatters all other metals, iron was the strongest metal they knew. And that would be an appropriate picture, a description of what the Roman Empire was, greater than any other empire before or since. Almost 1,200 years it endured. Super dominant, defeated all comers, way more powerful, way more extensive than any of these other empires had been. Also, when we get to chapter 7 and 8, we'll see that the sequence there requires that this has to be the Roman Empire. And it's, which is, yeah, that's an important point. Historically, the Romans overtook the Greeks, so that makes sense as well. So you have Rome. And now we come to the feet. With the feet, they're the same as the legs in that they have iron, and the legs are iron, and the feet are also partly iron, but then they're partly of baked clay. So they're the same as the legs, but they're also different. Up until now, every time there was a new empire, the metal changed to a different type of metal. Here, it kind of partly changes, but partly doesn't change. And, yeah. The conclusion is that they're referring to two different empires that are related to each other, but actually different. And this is something that we have in prophetic literature that we're going to run into several more times, so we might as well get into it. Something called the double reference or typology, where one entity predicts and foreshadows another. Okay, in double reference, One of the things that we're recognizing is that the prophet sees his vision kind of as an intuition of a picture. It's called a vision because he's seeing it like a dream or a movie, something like that. And so he sees two things that are similar, very similar in some way. But what's missing is that there's a gap in between them. So that, you know, no passage of time is mentioned. It just goes directly from one to the other. They call it a prophetic gap or a double reference. Has to be authorized by the text. You can't just say, oh, I think this is a double reference. I think this is a prophetic gap. The reader, the one who says there's a double reference here, has the full burden of evidence to demonstrate that that's what's intended in the text. So if we imagine this prophet looking out, he sees something. He sees something else. And there's a gap of time in between them. They call, from the Greek language, typos, or type, which we get the word typical from. Type meant like a die. And an antitupos is the cast. So you would press the die into the cast, and then when you pull it out, you get like a stamped sheet of metal. Typos and antitupos. If you look at the die and the cast, they look kind of similar. They got the same picture on there. If it's a coin, let's say, or a piece of, you know, a piece of armor, but one's the reverse of the other. So it's antitupos, not in the sense that it's against the other, but in the sense that it's over across from it and that it fits together. And so in between there is what we refer to as the prophetic gap. Jesus himself authorized this and made clear that prophetic gaps exist in biblical prophecy. A lot of times, the gap in time is the gap between Jesus' first coming and his second coming. In biblical prophecy, these two events, the first and second coming of Jesus, are presented as though they're one event. And people in readers at the time of Jesus had no idea that the Messiah was going to come twice. Of course, after Jesus' life, he said, I'm coming back. I will come back. I will not leave you as orphans and so on. He said it many times. But before that, no one realized that the Messiah, the chosen one, the Savior, was going to come more than once. They just assumed that there was one coming. And apparently this was set up this way on purpose so that people would not guess that there are two different roles that the Messiah would. One was a suffering servant who would die to pay for human sin. The other, a reigning king who would take over the world and restore it back to what it should have been all along. And since those two pictures are like antithetical, they're not compatible with each other. People's eyes just always went to the king. The Messiah is a great king. They ignored the part where he's a suffering servant. And so, as a result, they didn't see it coming when Jesus willingly went to his death. Nobody saw that coming. And it's not our subject tonight, but that's referred to as the mystery hidden for eons past, which if you're interested in learning more about that, ask whoever brought you here, and they can probably explain that. We got to keep going tonight. So, in this case, like that, yeah, double reference. What we have in the legs and the feet is a prophetic gap, a prophetic gap. And I'll give you five reasons why we know that this is a prophetic gap. First of all, the syntax. There are different parts of the body. Feet are not the same as legs. And up till now, each time he goes to a new part of the body, it's a new empire. Here he describes the legs in some detail and their strength. Then he says, as for the feet, and he goes to the feet next. Also, their composition is different. Iron does not equal iron mixed with clay. Some sort of a swirl, some sort of an amalgam that's a mixture. And up until now, each time the composition of the body changes, it's a different empire. Thirdly, in Daniel 2:44, he says that during the reign of those kings is when this stone cut without hand hits, and that represents God doing away with all human empire and basically restoring God as the true emperor, the true king, the kingdom of God. And it happens during the feet, during the 10 toes, he says. In fact, he calls attention to the 10 toes three different times in his recounting of the dream. And he calls them those kings. So that there's nothing like that that we can get from the history of Rome. There are no 10 Caesars, many more than that. Even people that have tried to single out 10 important Caesars really doesn't work either. Besides, it's clear that they are all together. They're contemporaneous because it's during their reign together that the stone fell. There's nothing in Rome that fits that either. Rome was one emperor, not 10 kings. And so this is something different. Fifth, correlation with other passages. Where in the next one that we're going to read, out of the fourth beast comes this other power. It has 10, in this case, 10 horns. The fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom, which will be different from all the others. He will devour, devour the earth, tread down and crush it. That's the Roman Empire. And then he says, as for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise. So not within it, but out of it. So you have the Roman Empire, and then basically it's saying some form of the Roman Empire is going to come back. It's not exactly the same. It's different. It's got 10 national entities that make it up. And that's consistent in all of these pictures. In fact, Revelation 13, verse 1, the beast with the 10 horns, each one has a crown on it, each one's a ruler. It says there are 10 kings who give their kingdoms to the beast. This is the climax of human history. In Revelation 13 and 17, this 10-nation grouping is still viewed as future in that day. And that is at the end of the New Testament period. So it's hundreds of years after Daniel. Still hasn't happened all the way down then. And Daniel 9:27 makes it clear that there's a gap here as well, because Jerusalem is destroyed during the Roman period, and then it reappears at the end of the prophecy when this evil world ruler, the beast, the Antichrist, shows up. Well, so it's different. It's related to the Roman Empire. It's different. It has 10 rulers. It comes out of the Roman people and culture. It's clear in chapter 9, the people of the princes to come. It's not the geography. It's the people and culture, which would really be European peoples and maybe their colonies as well. When you think of the Roman Empire, which included the Eastern Mediterranean and North Africa, those areas, because of the Muslim takeover, are nothing like Roman culture anymore. It's a different culture. Basically, it's mainly Europe that continues on with Roman style, traditions, thinking, Romance languages, jurisprudence, government. And it's a coalition. So it's basically Europe and maybe other related nations reunifying into something analogous to the Roman Empire. Europe. 10 nations at its core, but it's clear that there's way more than that that are involved in this. In the center are these 10 nations. It's as strong as Rome in some ways. He says here it has the strength of iron, and yet it has its brittleness. People are divided. It's not as cohesive and lasting as Rome was. And so it falls apart. Well, in 41 and 2, you saw that the feet and the toes baked of clay, partly of iron. This will be a divided kingdom. It'll have some of the strength of iron in it, even if you saw, as you saw, iron mixed with clay. And the toes were partly iron and clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong, partly brittle. It doesn't last very long. We'll find out that it really only lasts a few years, and then it falls apart. But very powerful. What we're reading here, and you will, I'm just going to state it for now. You'll have to come back next week and week after to see the how this lines up and why it's convincing. The Roman Empire is coming back, a version of it. The same people and culture that made up Rome. And that's basically going to be Europe and maybe their colonies, like places like here. English-speaking countries could be a part of this because we're more diverse than a lot of European countries are, but we basically, as a whole, our culture follows Roman thought and practice. And we're in that general European, Western European tradition. The new version is going to be strong like the old, but not as cohesive. Very important empire in the history of the world. According to the next prophecies we're going to read, this group, this 10-nation group, gains hegemony over the whole earth. And it leads to the end of history as we know it. Hegemony, meaning that you have such superior strength that you can intimidate everyone. Nobody wants to mess with you. The people look at this power and they're like, who is able to war with the beast? They basically are, they do whatever he says, even though he's not directly ruling their country, but they basically don't want to mess with him so he can get his way. And this is what the end of human history heads toward, is a great worldwide power, a dictatorship. And the guy at the head of it is really bad news. He's referred to as the beast. We'll study him next week. For right now, let's just ask ourselves this question. This idea of Europe reuniting like they have not been since the time of Rome. These are countries that have hated each other, that have continually fought wars with each other. Some of the most brutal, a couple of the most brutal wars in history. And many others, this has been a landscape of hate and war. The idea that these countries would come back together again, like they used to be. How plausible is that? Is that just ridiculous? Come on, these guys hate each other. Europe, unified into one political and economic entity, doesn't seem very plausible at all, let alone that they would become the most powerful empire on earth. And yet, during our own lifetime, something like this may be taking place. Let's look at the question of European unification. The Maastricht Treaty, signed in Europe, in the European Union in 1992, says the Union shall set itself the following objectives: to promote economic and social progress through the creation of an area without internal frontiers, through the establishment of economic and monetary union, ultimately including a single currency. Well, if you've been to Europe lately, you know that it's nothing like what it used to be. It used to be you were coming out of France into Germany, you were going to sit there for a couple or 3 hours while they took you in, checked out your passport, maybe searched your car, made you declare things and all this kind of stuff. So every border you crossed was that way. Nowadays, you go from France into Germany, there's just a sign there, welcome to Germany. Just like going from Ohio to Indiana. Nothing. And goods and people flow back and forth within Europe completely freely. They all have the same currency. This currency thing happened in 93. The euro came in. It's still there. Looking at their literature today, the biggest internal market in the world, with 30 million businesses generating the EU's GDP of 14 trillion euro, close to $20 trillion. This thing is huge. In fact, 500 million people live in the EU, more than the combined population of the United States and Japan put together. This is all coming from the EU website that you can read yourself. It's called Europa. And they put out these articles explaining who they are, what they're doing. Yeah, they go on. One of their articles on that site, the greatest EU, 50 greatest EU accomplishments, just came out this year. European Union's founders dreamed that a continent would one day become a place where people, goods, services, and monies could just move around freely, like a United States of Europe. European integration began when the founding members set about to create a single market in which goods, services, people, and capital would move as freely as within one country. The single market came into being January 1993. Another article on there, this is from last year. 1 year ago, after the British referendum, remember the British just left the European Union. And a lot of people thought, oh, so the European Union's losing it. Others are going to leave, it's, you know, they're going to fall apart. Hasn't happened, it's not going to happen. In fact, the British leaving the European Union might be, they were often the blocking force that would prevent so many things. They never did accept the currency. They kept the pound sterling. They were just very independent-minded. Having them out of there, according to these guys, after the British referendum, many predicted an inevitable decline of the European Union and imagined that the global strategy, what they call their global strategy, would stay in a drawer or would very soon be outdated. Others told us the change in the global strategy advocated for would have taken years to turn into reality or might simply never happen. This has not been the case. This is the vice president of the EU giving this report. I forget her name. On the contrary, we have moved fast and united, starting with security and defense. In this field, more has been achieved in the last 10 months than in the last 10 years. It's actually moving faster, and they're going into arms and an army, a shared defense, weapon systems. And, you know, Trump's kind of, we're not going to back, you know, stand behind you guys anymore. You're going to have to pay your own way. That's kind of increased their realization. We got to take care of ourselves. We can't count on them anymore. The new command center for the EU military training and advisory missions is now a reality. A coordinated annual review of national defense budgets is taking shape. Preparations for a permanent structured cooperation on defense among interested member states are moving forward. Yeah, she says, far from being outdated, the global strategy's push for a European Union of securing defense and complementarity with NATO, which includes us and all of our other partners, has been a reminder of the European Union's strategic interest in a cooperative world order. Well, yeah, Federica Mogherini is her name. This foreign and security policy, which has developed gradually over many years, enables the EU to speak and to act as one in world affairs. Acting together gives the EU's 28 members far greater clout. They're really seeing themselves, you know, they're going to have a shared defense. They're going to speak with one voice. And they have one currency. They have no internal boundaries that really matter. I mean, the pieces of reunification are right there. They call it the European Union. It's happening right before us. These are the, there's 28 total members, but some of them are considered inner members and some are considered later members. There's inner six who began it, the outer seven. Of course, you can take Britain off of that, so you can see that things can change in this quite well. There's 12 nations that are at the center of the European Union. How absurd is it that Europe might reunify with 10 nations at the center? Not absurd. Not absurd at all, as a matter of fact. I first heard this when I became a Christian at the end of the 60s, 69. And it just sounded so stupid. I mean, you know, They called it the EEC back then, the European Economic Community. No one had even heard of it. It just sounded like a bizarre prediction that Europe was going to reunify. And yet, every decade since, they move forward, they move back, but they keep moving forward. And the forward movement is substantial, and this might be exactly what we're reading. Whether this is it or some other entity, the point is the unification of these diverse countries that have warred and fought with each other endlessly, and that is happening right in front of us. Okay, one other point. What about this idea that this is like a powerful nation? Come on, USA. These guys are losers, so you must be kidding. Well, actually, their GDP bigger than ours. They're the number one in the world. They're much larger than us in population, over 500 million. In 88, Schmick Medley polled Americans to find out which countries they thought invested the most in human companies. 73% of those polled assumed that Japan accounted for the majority investment. 10% cited oil-rich Arab countries. Only 3% knew it was Europe by far that invests in the U.S. way more than any other country. The EU accounts, this is Silva and Sjogren, in their book, Global Dreams, EU accounts for almost 2.9 million American workers, or almost double the U.S. workers employed by the rest of the world combined. Europe and the U.S. very closely tied economically. Biggest investor in the U.S., Germany, by far, not even close. With such close economic ties to the U.S., we could imagine the last empire being a combination. The U.S. also follows the Roman culture and thinking in many ways and could easily be a part of this. Especially, I think, when we go next week and read about this power in Revelation 13, one of the things they say is, who can war with them? It's just impossible. And when I read that, I'm thinking, I see the U.S. as part of this, you know, because of the U.S. military. Is so extreme. Well, we'll see. We'll see. The U.S. could be a part of it. Here's the point. Could this such a resurrected reunification of what used to be Rome be the most powerful nation on earth? Yes, it could. And just as a footnote, it's usually not a very good idea to bet against the accuracy of biblical prophecy. Maybe it seems implausible, maybe it seems unlikely. Bible prophecy predicts things way more unlikely than this. The Old Testament biblical prophecy predicted that the Jews would be scattered across the world for a couple thousand years, and then they would come back and reform their nation. Something that no nation has ever done. No people have ever done anything like that. And it happened. So, if it says it's going to happen, yeah, it may seem super unlikely, and yet there it is. And then you see, and it starts to unfold, we'll find at least a dozen different areas where this is true. These same predictions predict things like technology that we have today that they had no idea there was such a thing back in those days. Well, at the end, where we read how you kept looking, and this stone was cut without hands and struck the statue, the iron, the clay, everything turns to powder and is blown away. But the stone becomes a great mountain that filled the earth. It's the kingdom, basically God taking over. After humans have exerted their, you know, imperial authority for all these sequences, then God's finally like, nerp! Boom! And now it's going to be God, actually, that really takes over. And this is his rejoinder, his answer to human empire, human autonomy. Well, okay. And we remember that that stone comes during that 10 kingdom outfit at the end. So, we're looking at a progression that basically follows ancient history up to the time of Christ, jumps from Christ's first coming up to the time roughly of his second coming. When you correlate this with the other passages, the interpretation starts to become unmistakable. And I'm just telling you that now. You'll have to see it for yourself. Come back and study through these. Read them for yourself. See what you think. It terminates with the kingdom of God, which could be closer than we think, based on a few things that make a lot of people think that a lot of these ancient predictions might be coming to a head in our own day. This whole idea that human history is just going to simply continue indefinitely, not going to happen. Okay, that is wrong. And in fact, human history, according to Scripture, is going to come to a terrible anticlimax where fallen humanity does its worst, and that we are on the verge of self-extinction before God has to finally pull out the whistle and just say, that's it, you had your chance. And that is going to be this takeover by God that happens when Jesus comes back. We'll look at these lines of evidence, and again, I hope you give the study a chance because it gets quite interesting. We'll go to chapter 7 next week, which expands on the same type of vision as this one, and especially the last part with the 10 nation business. And there you have Daniel 2. Yeah, God, it's easy to get the feeling that history's just hurtling forward to some crazy unknown future, but you have this all foreknown. You know exactly where this is headed, and you're going to basically get the last word. And we're for that. We think that's exactly the way it should be. It's about time you took the world back over. And we're just excited to know you, to get an inside track. Your prophetic word is pretty amazing, especially a lot of those prophecies that have already been fulfilled. And it gives us a lot of confidence in the ones that haven't been fulfilled yet. They're going to come true also. So we thank you that we can trust that. We pray for this study series, God, that we'll be able to hang in here and get the full picture. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.